the president, Walton Amawak being the first.
And the societies have changed much from basically hunting and home economy to an industrial society where you produce fish. And that have, through these plans, or in order to realize these plans, the Danish government have made a policy which made us concentrate into big towns, which means that we moved from the villages into the towns, and the housing there is high rises, big blocks, and it has destroyed the Greenlandic family's life, and it has cost us much to, it has put us a lot into a, for us, foreign way of value or way of living, which have and on the same time, the Danish way of society have grown up, like with bars and with the money deciding who is important and who is not important, and that have made, I think, made us as a people very, you know, it has taken our ground, sort of, that we had to adapt into societies like these. And our policies in the Landsting now is to build housing which suits our lifestyle, which means that you gotta have a view from your window. You cannot live in up, we gotta live by the shore, or and not in the fifth story house block where you cannot bring up either your catch or nor your tools as a hunter. And we have been thinking about to promote the building of like cultural houses where you can gather without having to drink liquor, where you can bring your kids and your family and eat or have a good time, where we can maybe situate our theaters and our artists and our musicians, so it can make it more as a whole. Today we have also much unemployment, which also causes these sad conditions that people drink.
Thank you. May I just ask one other question, since we're here at a time when the Elders Conference is considering the common language of the Inupiat people. In the Landsting, the Parliament of Greenland, the Home Rule Parliament, the people who are elected to sit in that parliament speak the Eskimo language, I take it. Is that a language common? Is it a language spoken by little children in Greenland as well as by middle-aged people and older people?
Yes.
And is it the language that children are... when they go to school, is that the language in which they receive instruction?
I must admit that maybe 70% of the teacher college, the teachers in our schools are not and non-natives, and that it is only 30%. And in case it is a Greenlandic teacher, they will always get their instructions in Greenlandic. But we have that big problem that our schools are too Danish. Even if that the Home Rule government took over them, they have failed to make the schools to promote our culture, to promote Greenlandic society. You know, it's more or less with Danish forbilleder. Kan nogen af dig sige forbilleder?
Danish model.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. After the Danish model.
If I are there non-native people in the parliament?
There is one at the present time.
And he would be of Danish descent, I take it.
Danish too. Danish what?
He's of Danish blood.
Yes, yeah. He is a Dane who was staying in Greenland for a while.
Yeah.
And it was in the last term, it was the first time that a Dane was elected. And it is because that, again, I think that is the money which decided that. The Home Rule government in the beginning, they decided to tax the Danes working in the airports, which is the American bases of Gerlesworth and Thule. And of course, with the tax, they wanted to have the right to vote within Greenland. And their vote gets one non-native into the parliament. And it is a very scaring perspective in the terms of our sovereignty in Greenland. And we are going to work on the law about both the right to vote. We want to extend the half year, which is the basis for permit.
Period of residency, we would say. Yeah.
Which gives allowance to a vote, to get it 5 years.
From what you say about the educational system, the children must be bilingual. That is, they speak the Eskimo language and they speak Danish. What about non-native people in Denmark? Do any of them or many of them speak the Eskimo language? Would that be unusual for them to speak it?
It is very unusual, and it is very not understandable for us that so few have been able to learn or at least articulate in Greenlandic. It's very, very few who may be interested and who would, like, I think, accept our way of life, who would learn Greenlandic.
You've been to Barrow before, and you've been here now, and I believe you were at Frobisher Bay last year. So you've seen something of the state of affairs in all three countries, where there are three of the four countries where there are Eskimo people. Do you think that the conditions are of the people and are generally the same? I know that's a pretty hard question,
yes, it is very hard. You really have to analyze that a lot in order to give a proper answer or a proper. Yeah. It is maybe something we in ICC have to realize and try to cope these times of colonialism to end, or take a standpoint from that and work, make ICC work for all of us, because it's. I think it will be very hard for us as individual groups to get freedom or independence or sovereignty.
Well. Thank you. I really want to thank you for making a presentation, and I know everyone is pleased that a visitor from Greenland was able to be here tonight for this hearing. And I could go on asking you questions all night, but I had better not do that. Maybe Eileen has given me the signal that I should call a 5-minute break now, and maybe we could take a break now and stretch our legs, and then we can reconvene and carry on as long as you want. Okay, everybody's...
Unless it's done in India.
Yeah, okay, fine. Well, maybe we should reassemble. Sure. Maybe we should start again, and maybe I should just say that that during the intermission we have had a summit conference about whether or not people are allowed to smoke in this room. And Mr. Thomas Brower says that in the daytime, the employees are entitled to come in here and smoke, and that's what it means when it says designating smoking area. And Mr. Edwardson agrees with him. And Mr. Ron Brower says, no, they're wrong, that you can smoke here at a public meeting in the evening, and that's why they got all these ashtrays. Well, we asked the highest authority in Barrow to rule on it, and he said that Mr. Brower and Mr. Edwardson are right, that that you can't smoke during a public meeting. It's in violation of Alaskan law. So so maybe we better bear that in mind and carry on. So we'll start off again then.
My name is Arnold Brower, Jr. I've lived here all my life, except for the periods of my high school education in by Sitka, Alaska, at the Mount Edgecombe High School, and during my service in the draft to the military in the United States Army. And in right after I graduated from high school, which I didn't get out till 1971. Prior to my service, I have been living and occupying land other than Barrow during my off-education months. During the summer season in areas other than Barrow, where I've made my habitat, I guess I would make that my base of habitat during my normal course of life in my Inupiat way of life. However, in reviewing all this, I find that when I come home, there has been some very important resolvements already taken place, and neglecting those of us that were in the military service. Either on purpose or maybe just ignorance. But Congress and the Alaska delegation and my own people and my own leaders had left me out for a parcel of land, a native allotment. I understand it nowadays that we had nobody else in the North Slope had no recourse but to file a native allotment, because my parents, my grandparents chose this community to be a city form of government, not an IRA, not an ICAS. ANCSL came about to the Arctic Slope Regional Corporation, which we are a part of now, to the Alaska Arctic Slope Native Association, because there were cities. Not if it weren't for those type of governments, the Angska law would not affect this North Slope. I had no part in that. I had no say-so in that. I was still in high school. I am left to combat this type of government for my livelihood, for my own children, and for the rest of us that have to live up here. I have seen and I can sense the forethought played by the late Mayor Eben Hobson for the betterment of our communities. He knew that if this happened, that we would have housing projects, we would have what we have today. However, looking back, I feel that we would still have that, and maybe a lot more, and a lot yet no anxiety and animosity between one another if this has not happened. Because it would have left us in a similar reservation as Vinatai. We would own the land and we would bid the lease sales. However, since we have adopted and voted for a city and a home rule type of government under the Statehood Act, and I understand the city of Barrow became a city prior to the Statehood Act. This does not leave us too much recourse, but only to combat just those issues that we have to deal with and amend and change those laws imposed to us because we are a home rule municipality. Our tax base upon our own residents is amendable and can be changed to something that we can live with. I feel neglected in only one area, about the only area maybe which I might find a slight satisfaction. If I had not been neglected for a similar case or a similar amount of land to be made available to all of us, those served involuntarily to defend somebody else's country. Our country was not in no emergency situation, and I feel this is a strong point that our legislative officers can deal with to amend law to restore our rights. I don't speak only for myself. I have made numerous attempts on articles in Anchorage and Fairbanks and Tundra Times to solicit those others in the state of Alaska to fight for that right. Today we face myself and a lot of my brothers and sisters, my relatives, my classmates from 1968, 67, because our government, our local governments, have to abide by state law, and that the state law has made laws that we cannot no longer freely select our land where we can build our homes, make our ice cellars to store our food, to put our meat racks where we want to put them free of dust. Those are the unfortunate circumstances that we face now. But there are ways and there are still legislative bodies which can amend. From our home rule government, from our city governments, so that they can meet our needs. Not pressure and sue government to government, but deal with them in a humane manner. The rest of the country, the lower 48, from what I read in the newspapers, needs the oil and the gas so that it can protect the country from other countries that might impose or declare war. And I respect that. However, since there is no emergencies, that those kind of things should not be given to us. Those kind of issues should not be talked with us so that we can enjoy our freedom, our heritage, our culture. These two line sites, for instance, during World War II, I believe, were set up for defense purposes. I feel that they are an important factor in the state of Alaska, in our country, because we Inupiat don't have no form of military. Although we have never been conquered, although that we have not conveyed the land to the United States, from my own learning in my high school education, it was taught me that no nation, no Americans, no Russians ever overtook or attempt the Eskimos in the Arctic slope. And I think this is our great privilege and our sovereign right to maintain our heritage and culture. And I think for your review, Commission, these are the important factors which we face today, that we are learning that we have to combat the issues now at hand, because we cannot just dissolve the North Slope Borough Home Rule Government without paying for all those bonds as the law that we've already entered into has those kind of stipulations. I feel privileged to speak here and before the Native Review Commission and before you, sir. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Brower. Thank you very much.
Justice Berger, my name is, for the record, is Michael Jeffrey. I've been living here in Barrow since January of 1977. And I agree with Arnold Brower, Jr. It's a privilege to be a part of this commission hearing and to present some material before you. As you know, I'm the judge here in Barrow, and I'm speaking here strictly as an individual, but I'm sure from your experience when you were on the bench, the fact that many of these issues may come before me at the court means that I cannot really discuss them very much. I do want to give you, however, a opinion that the Alaska Supreme Court handed down on June 22nd of 1984 in a case. I won't comment on it because it's a pending case that's going to be tried here in Barrow within the next few months, perhaps. But it deals with the situation of a village corporation and whether or not you can usefully use legal concepts that are used with other corporations, with the village corporation formed under the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. And you'll see when you read that opinion from the Supreme Court, which, by the way, disagreed with what I did, my decision, that there's a difference of opinion among the people in the Supreme Court. Some of them saying, well, this is a corporation just like any other. You just have to use the laws like any other corporation. And then one justice saying, no, Alaska Native corporations under the Clean Settlement Act are different, and you have to look at them differently. I was most interested in the other hearings. I've attended all of them here in Barrow, and at least the nighttime ones. And I was very interested to hear the claim settlement that had been done in Canada with the Inupiaq, who are up around the Beaufort Sea, because there seemed to be some very interesting ideas there that might be useful in terms of possible amendments to the Native Claims Settlement Act here in Alaska. I've also done reading in the past about some of the things going on in Canada. For example, how in some of the small villages in Canada you have cooperatives, which appear to me, although I'm certainly no expert on them, I just read something about them, but have many advantages which may be useful here in Alaska. Combining the idea of holding the land in common and the money in common, and yet allowing development and so on to occur, in other words, business ventures, so that there's income coming into the community, but nevertheless with the idea that you're not necessarily in the same legal box that a standard corporation is. And we've heard during these hearings, and I'm sure you've heard across the state, how the vehicle that the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act used of corporations chartered under state law has brought tremendous opportunities, but also many, many problems and discomfort. And I've read many articles of, for example, the corporation managers struggling with, on the one hand, under state law and under the advice of their attorneys and under the advice of their accountants, they have to behave in a certain way. And yet, on the other hand, feeling that they have a sacred trust for the land and for the culture of their people that they're also administering, and sometimes being torn apart by that, that it doesn't fit together very well. And it may be that in the deep look that the commission is taking at this whole thing, that you may find that simply making maybe not very major adjustments, it may be, for example, on issues like, as we've heard here at these hearings, the issues of like taxation of corporation lands. If they were not, again, like in Canada, it's interesting, the idea that the land should not be taxed, only activities on the land if they're done, but not the land themselves. Maybe something like that. or maybe some kind of adjustment in the stock so that it could be shared, again, as in Canada, in a way that every new birth, when they were 18, would have a right to somehow share in the corporation, again, like was true over in Canada. These are all very interesting ideas. And the only other thing I guess I'd say now is we've heard many statements about the white man's law and living in Barrow for now 7.5 years. I've been deeply challenged in those ways because I am living here as a person with legal training and now as the judge, and I'm trying to administer the state law in a way that fits with the state law. In other words, I'm sworn to uphold the state law, but also as much as possible fits with the needs of the community. And it's a very difficult position to be in. There are many ways that the community has to be involved in what we do over there. And there was some discussion last night about the criminal cases. Well, of course, in most of those cases, the final decision is made by the community because they're the jury. And so the community can stay involved. As much as people dislike jury duty, it definitely is a way that the community stays involved in what's going on over there. And they can look at the facts, and then they can decide if that person should be held responsible or not. I've found that there is room to have flexibility in the state law, and I'm making efforts to find out more about things up here so that I can use that discretion that I have, in the cases where I do have it, to bring it closer to the expectations and needs of people here. It's not an easy job, and I'm sure you must have felt that when you were a judge in British Columbia. I also know, of course, that you chose to stop being a judge. I've only been doing it for a year and a half, and I think at this point I'm still interested in giving it a try and doing the best I can. And of course, you did it for many more years than that. And so I don't know where we'll all end up. But I think that the timing of these hearings is very important because, as we've heard so often during these discussions and as we've heard like during the AFN conventions over the past few years, the year of 1991 is so important because unless the law is changed, there's this possibility of local people losing their rights to their future in their land. And unless the act is changed in some way. And there's been very active discussion among the Native community about this, and of course this effort, which is something that is very difficult to do, and is, I think, the Inuit Circumpolar Conference and the World Council on Indigenous Peoples have set up a good way to do it, especially by bringing yourself in and others who are outside the Alaskan situation, but yet understand what's going on here to some degree because of the similarities with Canada, to do this examination. And I think that by the time you produce your report, which I'm very interested in receiving and reading, will give the people who are concerned with these issues a chance to perhaps get something done in a way that will meet the needs of the people and be politically viable and so on. It's an issue that's beyond the courts. It's an issue that is in the political process. And unless the law is changed, the courts will have to enforce, of course, what the law says. So I thank you very much for having a chance to share in these proceedings. As I said, I found them extremely interesting. Thank you.
Well, thank you, Judge. You mentioned the cooperatives in Canada. They're often overlooked, but in the Eastern Arctic, where the bulk of the Eskimo people live in Canada, the cooperatives are the largest employer after the government, mm-hmm. Leaving subsistence to one side and not treating that as employment in the conventional sense. And they have too often been neglected because the government and industry are looking for oil in the offshore, or they are trying to develop a mine, or they're trying to undertake a gigantic project that means more to bureaucrats in the capital and people in industry, naturally, than some small little store in a village that is run by a community cooperative, or another little store that is selling arts and crafts as a community cooperative. And those undertakings are often neglected, and government sometimes ignores them while they pursue the big projects that careers are built on, whether you're working in Ottawa, our capital city, or whether you're working in Yellowknife, our territorial capital, or whether you're in industry and you want to get ahead. If you have a small-scale undertaking employing just a few people in a little village, it may be a great success in that little village, but it doesn't get you on the map with the big boys. And that's an argument for a larger measure of local control and local government. The Canadian Arctic Resources Committee is just now undertaking a study of the cooperatives to try to bring to the attention of Canadians and their government how important it is to strengthen the cooperatives. And I find it interesting that you would have raised the subject, because we take them too much for granted in the Canadian Arctic, and they are certainly worth preserving, and it may be that for Alaskans they're worth looking into, because they aren't corporations. And in fact, I've heard lawyers in Anchorage suggest the corporations here, the native corporations, might somehow be converted into cooperatives under Alaskan state law. That's another alternative that we'll be examining at some hearings we're holding in Anchorage in the fall. But well, I'll read this with great interest. I find it hard to believe that you were reversed, but these things happen. And thanks very much.
My name is Thomas P. Brower. I was born in Barrow, and I've lived most of my life in the Arctic. And listening to the younger people, it brings to my memories a lot of things that I have gone through before their time. And with this in thought, we have remarks made regarding co-op systems and so forth, where people have lived through the whole Arctic coast feeling that they have been living in those areas from time immemorial, true enough with their forefathers in some instances. But to myself, let me get back to this community of Barrow. Barrow, as I grew up, in the middle teens and a little after, there was not much more than a couple hundred people here. some of the people were, the majority of them were living at Point Barrow. But eventually they moved down towards Barrow. And then others came in from more like nomadic type of people, which my father used to call inland natives, people that followed the game, and they would follow the caribou in the winter months till spring, when they were caught in an area where they could not move any more following the game. They had to try and stop where there were fish and other things to supplement till they will be able to follow the game again. And a lot of them, those natives, would hit the Colville, those nomadic type of people. Some of them would hit Ikpikpuk, that's the Chip River. And as they came to those rivers, they knew eventually that there's going to be some people going up and down those rivers. And that's how they would be in contact with people, and they would come in if they're related or if they're stranded. They gladly would bring them down to like a community here. Most of them would bring them all the way down to where the end of the lagoon, a little above the what we call the shooting camp now, where their tank farm is up there, where the Navy put their tank farm. And some of them would go all the way down to the mouth of the Colville called Nirlit. And some, if they took the branch on the east side, would be at what we call Uliktuk Point. Those people, as they traversed, would gather fur and sinews, things they could use for trading amongst each with the coastal natives. The coastal natives would move along the inland routes, and Dad used to apparently go with those natives because he was married into them, and he learned the names of all these streams and so forth, that when they left Barrow here with loaded canoes to go up towards the mouth of the Colville or up into Uliktuk, even up to as far east as Collison Point, they would carry oil and raw hides like from the sea mammals. So those people that they traded with would be able to have something they could use for their own garments, for their mukluks, because they were nomadic people. With this in thought as a background of our people, I was watching when the schools became more and more larger in our community. The Bureau of Indian Affairs had all the school program. And I would say we were probably in the fourth to fifth grade level. That's the highest, to my feeling, that our education was being given us by the BIA. Not much more than fourth grade, I would say, because it was a very low level. We could hardly read and write. When the BIA came in and started working with the school program for the natives, they had the what we call the public schools, put up. They had the public schools. And those public schools had one family, like a man and wife, at first to come up. Eventually, as the schools, more children came, they would have another extra teacher. Still, they would employ one or two natives to help in the school program. Roy Amawak was one. And but before him, there were like Roy Amawak married Alice Aluk. I don't never knew her last name, but her maiden name, given name, was Aluk. And then there was Annie that came from a family down from Wainwright. And she stayed with some of the other the school teachers here. When the times when the Bureau of Indian Affairs boat, like the Boxer, and those ships would come in, they were bringing in supplies for the school, and Dad was the only one that had the trading post. But the school teachers start telling that they should have a co-op